This is a WTOP original podcast.
From Podcast One.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA.
Have you heard about the Pegasus Project? It's an international investigative journalism initiative that's revealed that governments have been spying on a lot of people, including a list of 50,000 phone numbers. All over the world, people have been targeted through their mobile phones.
And what we discovered is that NSO Group was leasing or selling or whatever they do, this software package to a lot of, I would say, less than democratic countries around the world.
Drew Sullivan is co-founder and publisher of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project.
And these countries were taking the software and essentially using it to spy on journalists, spy on opposition parties and candidates, to spy on activists, civil society, human rights defenders, and each other.
We'll tell you exactly how the spy program worked, technically and ideologically.
Coming up on this episode of Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. Russia
could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile,
capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
D.C. is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Cyber criminals.
Decryption successful.
America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm JJ Green. Imagine your mobile phone gets infected with malware from a source that you never clicked on, downloaded, or answered a call from. So how is that possible? It's because of something called Pegasus spyware, made by a company called the NSO Group. Thousands of people around the world, from presidents to journalists to lawyers to doctors to taxi drivers, were targeted. The Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project and several global media organizations recently dropped a deeply troubling series of reports about how this spyware works. It's called the Pegasus Project. Our guest today is Drew Sullivan. He's the co-founder and publisher of OCCRP, and he was on the front lines of this reporting. So, Drew, tell us what this is all about.
JJ, this was actually a joint project of about 70 news organizations and Amnesty International, who all got together to look at this particular issue and drill down into it. We called it the Pegasus Project. And the purpose was really to look at this NSO Group software and to see how it was being used. And what we discovered is that NSO Group was leasing or selling or whatever they do, this software package to a lot of, I would say, less than democratic countries around the world. And these countries were taking the software and essentially using it to spy on journalists, spy on opposition parties and candidates, to spy on activists, civil society, human rights defenders, and each other. And in many cases, you know, the prime minister and the president was being spied on in their own country, as well as, you know, other people within the administration, you know, government-friendly journalists, you know, it just kind of depicts, you know, what's going on in these very autocratic regimes that are popping up. They're incredibly paranoid, and they want to destroy any semblance of democracy in their country by using this against the people who are trying to be more democratic and, you know, basically looking at their paranoia and spying on the people that are working with them. So it was very interesting to look into how these governments work.
So tell us how this spy process worked, because it's my understanding.
Sure.
And as a journalist who's talked to some of the people on your list more than once, there is a concern that, hey, what about me? That it's possible for these people's mobile devices to be infected without them even knowing it. So explain how that works.
Yeah, this is what's called zero-click software, and it exploits weaknesses in cell phones and in various apps on your cell phone to essentially get in there without you having to click on anything. In the old days, they had to kind of do a phishing expedition where they would go out and send you messages and hope that you clicked on something. With this new software, they can essentially just get right on to your phone by sending you an iMessage that you will never see. And so it's using exploits that are in, you know, we call them zero-day exploits. They're exploits that are not known in you know, Google phones and in iPhones and probably other phones. And it's extremely difficult to see this happening unless somebody goes in and forensically looks at it. And the problem is once in your system, they have 100% control. They have more control of your phone than you do. In fact, they can look at your pictures. They can listen to you. They can turn on your camera. They can read your email. They can get the cookies or the various things that you've logged onto your Facebook, and they can get access to your Facebook account. They can get your bank account, pretty much anything. So anything your phone is connected to, they can theoretically go in and mine and use that in any way they want. And this is pretty high-end software. So in this case, it was mostly being used by, you know, governments to spy on people.
Where did this come from?
This was built by a software company called NSO Group, based out of Israel. And they've been around for about 10 years or so. And they basically just grew big, you know, with the growth of phones, you know, they just, you know, joined that wave and worked on cracking phones. And in the early years, they did things that were, you know, pretty crude. They would even call you up and try to get you to do something. But as the level of sophistication has grown and the company has grown, they've gotten these much more sophisticated exploits. And there's a whole business of this. I mean, you can go into the dark web and they sell these exploits when people find them, you know, for millions of dollars. And companies buy them and they use them to crack people's phones. And when they get patched, they find others or they have others in store that they can use. And a surprisingly large amount of apps and a large number of types of phones were easily exploited. And it looks like, you know, the Apples and the Googles are really not spending the money to secure these phones as effectively as they could. They had multiple exploits on these phones. This was not just one exploit. They, you know, when the phone would fix something, they would immediately have another exploit in its place. So it's pretty clear that the American businesses, which don't really pay a price for their phones getting hacked, you know, have been, to be quite honest, lazy and not spending enough resources really in securing their phones.
The list of people that you have that have been targeted by this software is kind of mind-blowing. 50,000 phone numbers, at least part of this leak of information you've got. There may be more, I don't know, but maybe you can tell us about that. But you've got journalists, activists, doctors, academics, lawyers, prosecutors, politicians, government officials, military officers, and business people. Who are some of the people that are on this list that have been targeted? And can you give us a sense of how some of these folks actually got targeted?
Yeah, so it was really quite interesting. I mean, this ranges from, you know, somebody's driver. Our journalist in Azerbaijan, her driver was hacked, and you know, as well as her, as well as family members, all the way up to presidents. So, you know, Emmanuel Macron in France seemed to be hacked by a client coming out of Morocco. South African president, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa. Mexican president AMLO, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, wasn't hacked, but 26 people around him, including family and assistants and other people, were hacked. He doesn't carry a phone, I believe, but every single person around him was hacked. And that was when he was not president. That's when he was an opposition leader. But 14 presidents and prime ministers were hacked with this. So, I mean, this really ran the gamut of everybody from the powerful to the low. It was whoever they wanted to get information from, these governments, they simply hacked. And, you know, some of it was based around, you know, big political events. Some of it was based around, you know, journalists getting out of prison or, you know, activists doing a protest. And as soon as they were, you know, they left the protest, their phones were hacked. A number of cases where there were meetings and everybody came out of the meeting with their phones hacked. You know, so it was all really dependent on what the individual intelligence or police agency was interested. What we found is we didn't find many terrorists or organized crime figures on the list. We found mostly, you know, journalists, as you said, and doctors and civil society people. And it really looked, you know, that it was these governments trying to spy on its own people so they know what they're doing. You know, when you run an autocratic government, you sometimes, you know, expect people to overthrow you. And I think these governments are naturally somewhat paranoid.
Can you give us a ballpark of how many governments you detected or found were using this, or did you? Or can you give us some of the top ones?
So this particular data was kind of clustered around 11 countries that we saw. And some of these went outside of these country blocks. So there were, you know, especially countries like Morocco were looking in France and other places like that. Some of them stayed exclusively within the country, and we don't know if that's because of limitations of their software or their agreement or whatever. But it looked like it was kind of 11 major ones. And some of the countries were, you know, Azerbaijan, Rwanda, Togo, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, you know, Morocco, Hungary was one of them. You know, so these are not the most democratic countries in the world. And we don't know what contracts out there. We don't know this particular set of data. You know, we're not sure, you know, why it was curated the way it was or whether it even was curated. So, you know, we're not privy to some of that information. Some of our other partner news organizations have a little bit more information, but, you know, it does seem like it was consistent with, you know, particular governments. Mexico was another one, and there were, you know, that was one that you could see that there was a lot of kind of clustering around, you know, both political in some cases, sometimes business people, and, you know, relatively few organized crime.
You know, one of the things that seems pretty interesting to me is there are three major countries that are not, at least according to your research, what you've gathered, targets or appear not to have any people on this list. That's the United States, Russia, and China. Is there any, and there's Canada as well. These are big countries, and these are important countries too. So what does that say about what you know right now?
You know, I suspect it has to do with some of the security these countries might have put in place. In some cases, it could, you know, this was a Israeli company. Spying on the United States has been an issue in the past for Israel. So that might have been some kind of limitation that they put on it so that, you know, people couldn't spy on Americans. You know, it's we don't know, to be honest. We just don't know. I suspect that, you know, that, remember, this is one of a number of companies that are out there, and it's contracts that they have, you know, with governments that they've made deals with. But there are other companies who have deals with other countries and have different sets of rules. And then you have the state actors. And increasingly, it's getting quite scary. There's a number of countries like United Arab Emirates, which was in this data, who are developing their own software. And we assume that is not going to be restricted in any way. And so this is kind of a new age. It's the age of information war, and you've seen it in the Chinese hacks that have been happening in the United States recently. There's a lot more. There's an active hot war of hacking each other. by these countries, and they're using this software, and they're using their own software, and they're using other tools, you know, including physical entry into places to get information that they need. So there's a hot war, world war, in information, you know, theft. And that's what's so interesting about this. This is the tip of the iceberg to what's actually going on.
So one question about the U.S. and the UAE, and something that I ran across a couple of years ago. And that was some information indicating that there was a whole group of former intelligence analysts who worked at the National Security Agency that ended up working for some project called, I think, Project Raven. In the UAE, and they actually had been, you know, helping them hack people inside the U.S., including, I think, the first lady at the time, Michelle Obama. So is this what you're talking about when you talk about this variety of unknown platforms?
Absolutely. I mean, this information is really important. World War II was won in many cases because, you know, in a significant way, because the United States had cracked the code of, you know, Nazi Germany and the Japanese, and that led to significant battles. And so victories in significant battles. And so this is happening, you know, and it's much wider. It's both, you know, they're not only interested in the political, they're interested in the technological, and they're interested in the commercial, and they're interested in law enforcement. And so, you know, governments are collecting information all the time. And quite frankly, information is very poorly protected, especially in the United States. In the United States, we really see it as an economic issue, and companies will not invest more money until it's economically important that they do that. And, you know, most companies who have been hacked in the United States are not obligated to tell you that they've been hacked. And so consequently, there's far more industrial hacking that's been going on in American companies than has come out in the media. And consequently, the damage is much more significant than people realize. And when this is taken to the military level and the political level and the, the industrial level, It really is pretty scary that people are having such an easy time accessing this information.
Is there any way to know if you've been hacked?
It's very difficult, and it's very difficult to protect yourself. You really have to have an expert look at your computer or your phone. You know, many of these softwares delete themselves, you know, when you turn off your computer, and they have to reacquire you later. They have to rehack you. And that's to keep, you know, proof on the computer. But there are some ways you can look at and some addresses that these softwares are sending information that are known to be related to particular groups, such as the NSO group. And that's how we were able to really identify what was happening. And so if you have that kind of expertise, but there just isn't the commercial expertise out there to service everybody. Most people are not hacked. You know, even though this is very, very widespread, most of it is dedicated to the Jeff Bezoses and the, you know, the Barack Obamas and the Donald Trumps and the people who are important, and the journalists, because a lot of information comes into journalists and goes back out. You know, so on the global scale, hacking is not going to be, you know, your dad or your, you know, your nephew. That's not going to happen except for small time commercial hackers. But it's going to get worse as we go on. And there's going to be tools, I imagine, that are developed, designed to help you get some better sense of what's happening on your machine. But until there's a significant improvement in the security of these devices, which are so, you know, close to us, we sleep with them, they're next to us all day long, and they can be turned into a Trojan horse. It's just, you know, reading your emails and watching you eat breakfast and doing all these things. And that's really, truly scary.
What do we need to know to or do to protect ourselves?
Well, I mean, I think the what you have to understand is sometimes it's if you don't want something stolen, don't say it or don't write it somewhere.
Yeah.
So if you've got really sensitive information, don't create that thing that can be stolen in the first place. Go old fashioned, meet with people,
yep.
Go out and have coffee with them instead of, talking to them on the phone.
You know what, believe it or not, sorry to interrupt, I'll let you get back to that, but I started doing this right around the time just before Edward Snowden did what he did. There was a group of us who work in national security who said, okay, this is no longer safe to do. So, yeah. We started doing exactly what you said, but please continue.
Yeah, you go, send a mail to somebody, that's not a more secure way of doing it. But I think really what you have to do is if you really are in a situation where you're concerned about your security and you do have information that you have to send to people that is valuable, you need to create multiple channels. I've got about 5 phones right now that I use, and I use them for different purposes. The other thing is, there are other tools that you can use. You can just use laptops like a Chromebook, that doesn't have a chip in it. It doesn't have a compute. It doesn't have a phone chip in it. It's a little bit safer. And then everything is stored in the web, which in an encrypted form. So, if you're storing information, you encrypt it. If your data is at rest, as we say, you encrypt it. And if it has to move, you encrypt it where you can, but you send it through multiple channels so that they can't get the full message.
The question that I was going to ask you before I kind of got so deep into the nuts and bolts was, what was it that you found? How would you summarize what you found and what it means?
What we found from looking at this data is that a large number of governments primarily use their surveillance capability to look at the people they consider at risk. And those are usually oppositional parties, civil society organizations, and journalists. And often they're looking at these people not to find out what they know, they're looking at these people to collect what we call compromat. Compromising material, is somebody having an affair?
Yep.
Does somebody like children? Is somebody gay? They'll look at things that will be used against people in that context of that particular country. That's what often they were doing. And then they were also using it to file charges against people. And to create a case to file criminal charges. And so these were countries that have really been destroying, anybody's ability to really contend their control of the country. And that's really where a lot of things are heading. I mean, it's these autocratic countries that are unfortunately captured states. They're in the control of a particular political party, and that party does not want to give up control. So one thing is to capture a state, another is to keep it. And in many of these countries, that's what it was that they were actually doing, is they were consolidating and keeping power and crushing the opposition.
Well, I want to say that this project that you put together, the Pegasus Project, is pretty phenomenal. It's very phenomenal, frankly. And there is so much information here. I would just encourage everyone to go look at this. And you see, again, what you said, there are 17 news organizations, I think, others that participated in this project. And this, the rigor of that kind of consortium is off the charts. And forgive me for using that kind of lazy terminology, but this is a true magnet for authentic journalists, this kind of work. And I think what you've done here is something that we hopefully will have much more of in the future. Before I go, I want to ask you one other thing. I don't want to end on this question because it involves a certain degree of hilarity, but I don't want to end on this question. I just want to ask it to make sure we get it in. I was reading your bio. It says, before you became a journalist, you were a structural dynamicist on the space shuttle for Rockwell Space Systems. You have a degree in aerospace engineering from Texas A&M, and you're a professional stand-up comedian, acting in four films, and you play the Buran in the only authentic Irish Celtic band in the Balkans. So the question I want to ask you is, how does all of that add up to today? I mean, how did you use all of that to do the work you're doing today? How did it contribute?
Well, but, hard work and hard play.
You got to have hobbies, huh?
Exactly. You gotta, you know, the life as an investigative reporter on organized crime and corruption is not always uplifting career. And so you have to have some time to blow off steam.
Yeah. So you did that. And congratulations to you for being able to do that. I'm curious to know what those films were, but I'll ask you that offline. But before we go back to the serious nature of what it is we're doing today, is there more to this? Are you continuing to dig on this?
Certainly. I mean, we've only been able to identify, you know, 95-96%. Only 4% or so, 95 or 96% of these phone numbers are still not identified. So there's a lot more names in there.
Wow.
We'll continue to look at this, and we follow all our stories up. I mean, nothing ever dies. You got to keep following things up. And, you know, this is a group of organizations that are really good. And, you know, they're all going to continue looking at these issues and following them as they develop. And, you know, when you do a story like this, sometimes people give you more information. You know, it leads to additional stories.
Well, again, congratulations, because this is brilliant work. And I've been a fan. Didn't think I'd have the opportunity to talk to you today, because I wasn't really thinking that I'd be working on this today. But when the opportunity came up, I said, this is an absolutely perfect opportunity to talk about this, considering what's going on in the world today, especially in the United States, when we talk about China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and, you know, the freelance hackers, et cetera, people using traditional methods of hacking, or what we call traditional now, to hack into governments and important people and just regular people and organizations. To have this information out there today introduces a whole new level of understanding, I believe, for people when we start looking at the risk and the trouble that's out there. So thank you for this. Is there anything you want to add?
I just want to say that you've done a great job, and I always enjoy your reports.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm hopeful that we'll have another opportunity to talk with you again in the future.
Anytime, JJ.
That's it for this episode of Target USA. Coming up in our next episode. Over the last 8 months,
we have seen cybersecurity incidents across this country of a fairly unprecedented scale and impact.
Eric Goldstein, Executive Assistant Director for Cybersecurity at CISA. Russia and China are linked to most of them and have ignored polite U.S. appeals to knock it off. So now the U.S. is naming and shaming.
Attribution is incredibly important.
John Dermody is a former National Security Council lawyer, now with the firm O'Melveny.
But it's not in of itself going to deter committed actors.
Specifics about how to do that coming up in our next episode. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments about our program, send me an email at jgreen@wtop.com. That's the letter J, the color green, one word, at whiskeytangooscarpapa.com. jgreen@wtop.com. Also, we encourage you to follow us on Twitter. We're at TUSA Podcast. That's at Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast. Also, if you'd like to subscribe, we would welcome that too. If you want more information about national security, sign up for my newsletter. It's called Inside the SCIF, and you can sign up at WTOP.com/alerts.
I'm JJ Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good night, and welcome to T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio Podcast, the most fun you'll ever listen to while you're folding your clothes. Now let's get this straight, this is not your average podcast. T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio is super fun, super crazy, it's pretty much an in-your-face conversation. That's the good thing about us, we don't do interviews, we do conversations. All of my guests, all of my co-hosts, we chill, we drink, we play games, we have the song of the week, we have the creative curse word of the week, as long as you're having fun as our guest. Speaking of guests, each week I'm gonna go through my whole contact list and dive headfirst into the world of music, gaming, exotic cars, tech, strippers probably, doctors probably strippers that are only stripping so they can pay for tuition to become a doctor. You never know. My wife is a certified bartender. She'll make you a drink while you're here. We'll get you drunk and make you play VR after. It's a lot going on, but that's what it's all about over here at T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio Podcast. See you soon, baby!
Now, stay tuned for the latest headlines from the Associated Press.